From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. Ukraine is bracing for more Russian attacks in retaliation for the car bomb killing of Daria Dugina over the weekend. Dugina is the daughter of a Russian intellectual and a Putin ally named Alexander Dugin. Today, Russia officially blamed Ukraine for her death. Meanwhile, Ukrainians will celebrate their Independence Day on Wednesday, which will also mark 6 months since the Russian invasion began. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny is in Chernihiv in northern Ukraine, and she's with us now. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And let's start with this car bomb. Russia now formally accusing Ukraine's special services for the murder just outside of Moscow. What more do we know about the bombing and its repercussions so far?
Yeah, so Ukrainians deny that. Speaking on Sunday on a morning TV show, Mykhailo Podolyak, top advisor to Zelensky, Ukraine's president, said that her death was the result of domestic instability in Russia, so not any particular action from Ukraine's military. You know, I should note that both the father and daughter Dugin here, have been advocating for the Russian invasion of Ukraine for over a decade. They have claimed on many occasions that Russia can only thrive if Ukraine is totally destroyed.
Hmm. Well, meanwhile, in Ukraine itself, there was more shelling in Zaporizhia at the power plant in southeastern Ukraine over the weekend. Yesterday, President Biden called again for the United Nations nuclear watchdog to visit the plant. What's the risk at this point of a nuclear disaster?
The concern is about kind of the most vulnerable systems around the plant, which are the power lines that lead to the station and the water supply. Over the last month or so, a number of rockets and shells have landed on the territory of the plant, although it's still unverified kind of who was responsible. We have heard from experts that even if the plant is damaged, which would be a huge concern, it would be very far from a Chernobyl situation where there was an internal explosion. Right now, as you said in Biden's note and the messages that we're hearing from other Western leaders, is, you know, there really shouldn't be any military operations near the plant.
Yeah. Alyssa, can you tell us what is happening, big picture here? You know, we're seeing that Ukraine is attacking Russia behind enemy lines and in places like Crimea. But as we approach 6 months now since this invasion began, mm-hmm. You know, where are we? Have the front lines really moved much at all recently?
So recently, you're absolutely right. They haven't moved much. You know, there's active fighting where Russia has captured territory in the east and in the south. But Russia has, you know, held the southern city of Kherson. That's right in the south. Ukrainian forces are working on counteroffensives there. But the big lines really haven't moved. There have been missile strikes continuing throughout those areas and others. But while Ukraine has kind of seen this influx of more intense, more strategic weapons, they still need trained forces to operate them. And that's kind of where we've seen this stalemate.
Hmm. Later this week, on Wednesday, Ukraine's going to celebrate 31 years of independence from the Soviet Union. This is a big day on the calendar, and you've been talking to people there about what this day means.
Yeah.
What are you hearing?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it certainly carries for many a different meaning this year. I mean, it's also the six-month anniversary to the day of the Russian invasion that started in February. There's a real kind of heightened awareness of the day. You know, I talked to a woman here in Chernihiv, and she told me, you know, she never really thought of it. It was just kind of a holiday, and it just has a lot of meaning this year because independence, like, that's something her country is fighting for right now. You know, they're celebrating independence on a day where it's in jeopardy. And so I think that's kind of the big feeling here. Celebrations are going to look a little different this year. Ukraine's culture ministry said there's going to be no big public celebrations to mark the holiday. In fact, in Kyiv, they've actually put a ban on mass gatherings starting today until the day after Independence Day. But I do want to mention that there is a new twist on a military parade happening in the capital in Kyiv right now. A number of kind of burned out husks of Russian military equipment has been sort of decorated along the main strip in Kyiv. Thousands of spectators have come out this past weekend to look at it, to take pictures. It's like an alternative wartime celebration.
Interesting. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reporting from Ukraine. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And now some disturbing medical news. Late-stage cervical cancer is on the rise in this country, and it has been doing so for two decades. A new study in the International Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecological Cancer finds that Black women are most likely to be diagnosed with late-stage cervical cancer. But white women are seeing cases rise very quickly. What might be behind this, and can these cases be prevented? Let's talk now to Dr. Jessica Shepherd. She's founder of Her Viewpoint, an online women's health forum, and she's a board-certified OBGYN and chief medical officer at Very Well Health. Dr. Shepherd, hello.
Thank you for having me.
First, what is cervical cancer and how is it contracted?
Now, cervical cancer is a gynecologic cancer that specifically impacts the cervix, which is the lower portion of the uterus. Now, cervical cancer is contracted usually through HPV, also known as human papillomavirus.
Okay. Now, this new study looked at around 30,000 women diagnosed with cervical cancer at a late stage. And overall, it found cases increased 1.3% a year. Now, some might say, well, that doesn't sound like a lot. What do you make of this top line number?
Well, for one thing, we know since the advent of Pap testing and most recently HPV testing, we have seen a decline over the last few decades. So to see an increase of any percentage is really discouraging.
Can you help us understand one key finding here, and that is the incidence rate for Black women compared to white women?
Absolutely. When we look at the rates and even when we look at studies, we know that the incidence of cervical cancer among Black and brown women is significantly higher than we do see in white women. And those mortality rates as well are significantly higher in the Black and brown community.
Why might that be?
I think that there are a lot of reasons for disparities in healthcare, and a lot of that has to do with access to healthcare. And also, when we look at guidelines are a big part of screening process and really decreasing the numbers that we see in cervical cancer. And when we have certain guidelines that are for women by age and also by the abnormalities of the tests that, and results that they get, we really do require different follow-ups for these women. And when we have a decrease in that time of follow-up, we are going to see better rates of catching cervical cancer early.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, this study finds that white women seem to be statistically catching up, as it were. For white women in the South in their early 40s, cases went up a much faster 4.5% every year. What could be going on there?
Now, I found that this was a very concerning finding in this study because, again, this is the steepest annual rise in new cases of advanced cervical cancer. Now, advanced cervical cancer means that the disease has moved beyond the cervix and is really impacting other parts of the pelvis. And that is concerning because we are going to see a higher mortality rate when someone has an advanced disease state of cervical cancer. So bottom line is that we know that regular screening is going to decrease the risk of having cervical cancer. And what we have found is that non-guideline screening, which is recommendations of when to get your Pap screening and HPV testing, when you don't follow those specific guidelines and also consider vaccination, that's when you're going to see an increased risk of cervical cancer and advanced cervical cancer rates.
This is, as you're saying, a very deadly cancer in the study. The rate of living 5 years or longer with this late-stage cancer is about 17%.
Mm-hmm. And this is why, you know, it really matters, the message that we have to our women, no matter what group, no matter what ethnicity, is that we have screening that's available with the Pap and HPV. And we do have the ability to potentially, hopefully, eradicate this disease in the future if we do start vaccinations at a younger age, and also for our women who maybe have passed that age of vaccination, is getting them for their annual screenings.
We are, of course, in the middle of a vaccine conversation in this country. What is happening on the vaccine front?
We have had somewhat of a difficulty maybe getting this messaging to every woman. And also, I think that there are some concerns with the conversation, especially with young girls getting vaccination. There may be some people who are hesitant to expose their children to vaccines. And also with this one, specifically because how cervical cancer is transmitted is usually through sexual intercourse, is that brings that into the conversation. However, we do know When we are able to prevent early stage cervical cancer, we can decrease mortality significantly and decrease the rate of having women to have to go back and possibly have the anxiety that comes with an abnormal pap smear or having precancerous cells or early stage cervical cancer. And that's what we're really trying to prevent.
And can adults get the vaccine as well?
Now, we do have good data that has allowed us to increase the age at which women can get their vaccines. Oh. Before, this used to be between the ages of 11 and 26. But most recently, we have seen that pushed out for women up until the age of 45.
Okay. Dr. Jessica Shepherd is a practicing obstetrician gynecologist and chief medical officer of Very Well Health. Dr. Shepherd, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Have you ever been torn apart by the loss of a dog or a cat or even a pet tortoise? Have you then been told just to get over it by well-meaning family and friends? Well, our next guest is here for you. E.B. Bartels has owned many pets over the years, including fish, birds, a tortoise, several dogs, and she has had to cope many times with what happens when it's time to say goodbye. So in her new book, Good Grief, E.B. Bartels explores how we deal with pet death as human beings, and she travels to pet cemeteries around the country and even abroad to get some insight into how it's happened over the years. She joins us now to talk about it. E.B., welcome. It's so good to speak with you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I've met a lot of experts in my career doing this job. I've never spoken with anyone who knows more about dead pets than you do. Tell me, what's compelled you to learn so much about the way we grieve for our animals?
Well, I was drawn to the topic quite simply because I'm someone who's had a lot of pets, and those pets keep dying. Unfortunately, that's what happens when you love animals. They just don't live as long as people do. And so I was interested in understanding better all the different ways that people approach mourning and grieving their animals, since there's no one real universal or societal go-to way.
I don't think we always talk about this much, but losing a pet, it's intense. It hurts a lot. And I remember just last summer we had to euthanize our little dog, Lele, and I was absolutely shocked by the level of my grief. Why do you think our connections run so deep like that?
Well, I'm really sorry about your dog. It's so hard to lose a family member like that. And I think humans are very quick to try to compartmentalize things or rank things, right? So with grief, you know, I've diminished my own feelings in the past where I've thought, oh, you know, it was just a dog, it was just a bird, you know, it wasn't like, you know, a human being died. And the truth is, though, that we can have really deep, special, important relationships with animals that sometimes are even more profound than our relationships with other people. I interviewed so many people for my book who said it hit me way harder when my cat of 20 years died than when, you know, my dad, who I was sort of estranged from, passed away.
Mm. It's real grief, isn't it? I mean, I remember talking to the vet who came to our house to euthanize our dog, and I was crying, and I had to apologize to her, of course. I know I shouldn't have, but I said, I'm sorry, I'm doing this. And she said, you know what? The ones I worry about are the ones who don't cry.
Yeah, I read many books by great psychologists and psychiatrists about grief and by biologists about human-animal relationships, and all of them kind of pointed to the fact that with pets, often they feel almost like an extension of ourselves, even more so than a family member, because you can be really your most uninhibited, free spirit, silly, goofy self with your pets, and they don't care. Like, they just love you for who you are. So I think that losing a pet can be really devastating. And another psychologist pointed out that we can be physically close to our pets. Like, we cuddle with them. They often sleep in our beds at night. You know, I mean, I haven't done that with my tortoise yet, I guess. But, you know, we can be physically close to them in ways that often we aren't with other people. And that can be a really big loss then when they are no longer around.
A part of our culture these days is that pets are a part of our families. Some people will spend thousands of dollars to keep their pets alive if they can. But how do we know when it's time to make the decision to say goodbye?
That is a really hard question, and I wish I had a better answer. I asked every single vet I interviewed for this book that question. One of the best pieces of advice I heard was sort of the three things rule. Allie Coates, who's a vet in Western Mass, said that, you know, think of three things that your pet loves to do. You know, maybe it's like swim in the lake and chase a tennis ball and, you know, loves to eat carrots. And on any given day, if your pet can still do all three or two of those three things, okay, then your pet's probably in pretty good shape. But if you start to notice that even the things that they absolutely love to do more than anything in the world are becoming challenging or they're not interested in doing them anymore, then, you know, that's when you really need to start to think about, you know, am I holding on because I'm having trouble letting go? And what's best for my pet here? Are they in pain? Are they suffering? It's hard, though, because every animal is so different.
Yeah. Can you imagine being a veterinarian? I mean, these are people who see their patients die so often. How does that weigh on them?
It's really hard for vets. I spoke to probably like 25 or 30 different vets for this book, and all of them brought up the really high suicide rate, actually, among veterinarians. All of them had lost colleagues to suicide. And I think that part of why I wanted to write so much about the vet perspective in my book is to really remind people who are grieving, you know, that it's really easy when you're grieving and angry and upset to kind of lash out and, you know, blame the vet, you know, oh, you said the surgery would fix their cancer and it didn't work and they died anyway. And, you know, vets are people and they're just trying the best they can and they want what's best for your pet too. And I had a lot of people tell me they got really angry at their vet when the vet suggested maybe it was time to consider euthanasia, but they admitted later that they just didn't want to hear that because they were sad and upset. And the vet really was doing what was best for the animal or thinking about what was best for the animal.
You wrote a chapter in the book about the death of celebrity animals that I really enjoyed. I thought it was fascinating. You tell the story about visiting the gravesite of the great Triple Crown winner Secretariat, of course, the horse that won the Belmont Stakes by an astounding 31 lengths in 1973. Let's listen.
And the set. Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance.
Secretariat, a hero in life, but what did you learn about grieving for animals when you were in Kentucky and you saw firsthand how these great racehorses were memorialized?
We can really be profoundly impacted by animals who aren't our own pets, who are famous and lots of people know and love them. And Secretariat in particular came on the scene when people were going through a hard time in the United States. There was war, and seeing such a joyful, successful racehorse really brought a lot of people's spirits up. So in Lexington, it was really amazing to see these whole horse cemeteries and monuments to these amazing racehorses. One of my favorite facts is when Man of War, who is another legendary racehorse, passed away, the whole city of Lexington shut down for the day. So everyone, like kids, didn't have to go to school. So everyone could come and pay their respects to Man of War, who lay in state, sort of like a U.S. president.
You know, this love and affection, the need to preserve the memory and or the bodies of the pets or these animals, you know, is not new. This is not a modern phenomenon, is it?
People have loved animals for millennia. You know, my first chapter of my book is all about how in ancient Egypt, people would mummify their pets. They would bury them with them and hope to be reunited in the afterlife. There are animal mummies in Peru. There are ancient dog cemeteries in Siberia and Israel. And people have loved animals for as long as they've welcomed animals into their homes and lives. And to me, if you've loved an animal, you also then grieve an animal. So it's nothing new.
Yeah. And you went to many of these places. You went to a Buddhist shrine for pets in Japan. In Vermont, there's a place called Dog Mountain where people have left just thousands and thousands of photos and notes to their dogs that have died. What do you think about the depth of these connections? I mean, what does it tell us? Not so much about the death of these animals, but the way we live.
To me, the way that people mourn their pets and, you know, have these big mausoleums and statues and plots and pet cemeteries and portraits painted, it just shows to me the depth of their love and the joy that pets bring them. And a question I returned to a lot was sort of, why do we keep having pets? You know, no one forces you to go adopt a dog or get a kitten. And you go into it knowing in 10, 15, 20 years, you know, you're going to have to say goodbye and it's going to be devastating. And so my question that I kept returning to was, are we just masochists? Why do we keep doing this to ourselves? And, you know, there's really something worth it. I just always think about the complete unconditional love that our animals give us. You know, my dog Seymour had to go through a pretty hard heartworm treatment last spring at the vet, which involved us giving him shots and drugs. And it was awful, right? But he never once held a grudge against me and my husband. Mm. He still loves us. He snuggles with us. And, you know, he just is totally unjudgmental in the way he loves us. And it feels really special and lucky to have a relationship like that.
Well, it is. And let me ask you this final question then. Do you spend time thinking about the day that Seymour will die? Because I know I think about that for my remaining dog, like on a daily basis. And sometimes I think that's weird.
Oh, it's not weird at all. I think about it like every single time I walk Seymour. He has a really incredible prey drive. So he's always trying to run into the street to chase squirrels and rabbits. And he hates trucks. And he's always lunging after trucks. And, you know, I'm always thinking about, oh my gosh, this walk, he's going to pull the leash out of my hand and go sailing into the road, and that's going to be the end. And yeah, I think about it all the time, and I talk to friends and interview people who have the same kind of dark thoughts. But, you know, I think in some ways, pets bring us so much joy because they force us to remember how short life is and how fleeting our time is together. And so, you know, even if Seymour gets hit by a car tomorrow while I'm walking him, at least we've had, you know, a few really special years together. And I'm really grateful for that time.
E.B. Bartel's new book is called Good Grief on Loving Pets Here and Hereafter. And I know there are a lot of people who are hearing this thinking about the pets that they've lost and loved over the years. And I want you to send a memory or a picture to me. You can send it to letters at hereandnow.org, or you can find me on Twitter. E.B., thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Peter. This was wonderful.
Commuters in Boston are dealing with the first weekday with a main subway line down. On Friday night, the city's Orange Line went dark for 1 month. The reason is major repairs. About 100,000 people take the Orange Line every day, so now the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority is running shuttle buses to get commuters where they need to go. Here's one.
Good morning, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Orange Line shuttle bus. Yay!
Woo! For more of a look at this morning and how it went, we're joined by WBUR reporter Simon Rios. Hi, Simon.
Hey, Scott.
So tell us more about how this morning went, the first weekday commute with no Orange Line connecting Boston to Somerville and Medford and Malden.
Well, I think many of us were expecting it to be a lot worse than it actually ended up being. I was out there from 5 a.m., and there were very few cars on the road for the first several hours of the morning. That probably has something to do with all the warnings about incredible gridlock that might result from this Orange Line and part of a separate line, the Green Line, being shut down as well. But there were more than 200 buses doing circles along the Orange Line, and everywhere I went, there were four or five buses lined up loading passengers, and the buses were moving along nicely because of the lack of traffic. I should say that could change in a couple weeks when school starts. But Scott, I want to emphasize what an unprecedented move this is. It's the first time in the history of this century-old transit agency that they shut down an entire line for maintenance. The agency, which we call locally the T, says it can complete 5 years worth of night and weekend work in just a month.
Ambitious. Well, as you're describing, a lot of people have been encouraged to work from home. Not everyone can. Who did you run into this morning during rush hour?
That was the sense I got, that most riders on the train, at least the ones I spoke to, were in the service industry and could not work from home. So hospital workers, restaurant staff, you name it. I also noticed that it was almost entirely people of color, Black and Latino folks. Boston is, as they say, a majority minority city, but it's not so monolithic in normal times, but it was almost 100% Black and Latino riders today. I spoke to one gentleman, Charles O'Neill from Easton, Massachusetts, and he talked about how frustrating it is to have this line shut down.
Because, you know, a lot of people, they're disgusted with the T because of the fact that they seem to do things like this, and it messes with work in their loop. You know what I'm saying? It really, really does. I mean, I understand that they have to try to fix things, but the point is, man, there's a lot of people in this world.
And just quickly, Simone, why the shutdown of the Orange Line now?
These last couple of years, there's been a steady drip of increasingly bad news out of the T. I mean, runaway trains and sleeping conductors, crashing trains, an escalator suddenly going into reverse and throwing dozens of people to the ground. And then just a few weeks ago, an Orange Line car caught on fire and a passenger was seen jumping into the Mystic River below. That seemed to be the last straw.
That's WBUR reporter Simone Rios.
This week in New Mexico, the Santa Fe Opera presents the final performance of its world premiere of M. Butterfly. It's a new spin on a well-known opera that dates back more than a century. Here in Now's Emiko Tamagawa went to see it and has our story.
You might think M. Butterfly should sound like this. But that's from the opera Madama Butterfly, composed by Giacomo Puccini. Leontine Price plays Cho-Cho-san, a Japanese girl who marries an American naval officer named Pinkerton. He deserts her and marries an American woman. When Pinkerton returns the claim his and Cho-Cho-san's son, she kills herself. Chinese-American playwright David Henry Hwang used Madama Butterfly as a launching point for his play M. Butterfly. However, it was also inspired by the incredible but true tale of French diplomat Bernard Boursicault. In 1983, Boursicault and his Chinese lover were arrested and charged with espionage. During the trial, it was revealed that Boursicault's lover, who he long believed was a woman, was actually a man. The play won a Tony Award when it premiered on Broadway in 1988. A 2017 revival starred Clive Owen as the French diplomat, who Hwang renamed René Gallimard.
I spent night after night watching our story play through my head. One where she returns at last to my arms, for I have known and been loved by the perfect woman.
The perfect woman Gallimard has fallen in love with, of course, is a man. In the play, he's called Song Li Ling. Now, 5 years later, M. Butterfly is an opera. David Henry Hwang's words set to music by Chinese-American composer Huang Ruo. When it came to casting the role of Song Li Ling, Ro had a very specific vision.
I would love to cast a countertenor for the role of Song Li Ling.
A countertenor is a male singer who can sing in a high register. They are able to reach notes equivalent to a woman singing alto or mezzo-soprano.
Then the second step we took is to look for an Asian countertenor, because an opera like Anne Butterfly is so much about East and West, so much about racial and sexual conflicts.
For example, Huang subverts the stereotype that Madama Butterfly perpetuates, the submissive Asian woman who exists only to service the needs of a white man. He uses that myth to illustrate how the West often misunderstands the East, and how misunderstanding could have led to French and American failures in Vietnam. But Rowe also wanted to provide opportunities for those who are often overlooked.
I want to create a famous, important singing role for Asian countertenor. If we don't do it, who? When should we wait until that chance to come? If an opera like Anne Butterfly doesn't insist on proper casting for Asian countertenor, what are the chances?
But it seems like a bit of a big ask. You need a man who can be a convincing woman, sing both like a man and a woman, who's also Asian. Enter countertenor Kang Min Justin Kim. Kim's first appearance in M. Butterfly was dramatic. Hearing him, my jaw dropped. At an embassy party, diplomat Gallimard is enthralled by Song Li Ling's performance of one of Cho Cho San's most famous arias from Puccini's Madama Butterfly, Un Bel Di.
I have a lot of parallels with this role because my husband is French. I met him while I was performing in an opera in Paris, and I have dabbled in drag, and like I get to play a female character on stage.
Kim was born in South Korea, grew up in Chicago, and studied musical theater and computer science at Northwestern University in the early 2000s. But he was also building a career on YouTube. In 2011, his tribute to famed soprano Cecilia Bartoli went viral. Kim left computer science and the United States behind to study music and perform in Europe. But the idea of starring in an opera version of M. Butterfly was just too tempting to pass up.
I have done monologues and scenes from M. Butterfly before. So when I heard about this project, I had to drop everything and be a part of it. So I worked really hard and memorized everything and showed up at the audition with like full staging.
And composer Huang Ruo fell in love with Kim's voice.
He sang Un Bel Di, and then he sang Every Western Man's Fantasy. And Justin was able to sing that entire 8 minutes live for us. Once I heard that, I was sold. This is my butterfly.
It's one of your favorite fantasies, the submissive oriental woman and the cruel white man. What would you think of your lipstick and love with a Japanese? He treats her cruelly because of her figure then when she lands. He knows me.
Kang Min Justin Kim's performance in M. Butterfly has gotten some great reviews. The New York Times' David Allen praised his alluring, ringing tone and sensitivity as an actor. After the performance, Someone I was with speculated that M. Butterfly could be for Kangmin Justin Kim what the 1951 classic The King and I was for the late Yul Brynner, a role he could return to for decades. Kim seemed receptive to the idea. However,
at the same time, I really wish that this opera continues and opens other doors for the next generation of Asian countertenors. If this role can become a dream role for the next generation singers, that'd be so, so, so wonderful.
And for composer Huang Ro, more productions of M. Butterfly would further what he sees as the opera's mission, to inspire audiences to take a new look at an often misrepresented community.
As Asian, I want to be seen, I want to be heard. And hopefully this opera is one way for me, myself, and also so many of us to be seen and heard.
The Santa Fe Opera's M. Butterfly closes this Wednesday. For Here and Now, I'm Emiko Tamagawa.
More parents across the country are choosing to homeschool their children rather than putting them in a public or private school. The pandemic is one reason, but there's more to it, at least for families in South Florida. From member station WLRN, Yvonne Zumtobel reports.
Another great thing about it is Apple Day's Pajama Day.
Oh yeah, you could just spend the whole day in your pajamas, unless you go outside. Yeah.
Every day could be Pajama Day, but on a recent Friday morning, these 2 9-year-olds are outside, and they're not wearing pajamas.
Let's go play.
Matthew Gilbert and Nathaniel Trasco are classmates of sorts. They learn and play together, just not in a traditional classroom. Their parents brought them to socialize with about a dozen other homeschoolers here at this playground in Royal Palm Beach. Nathaniel has been homeschooled his entire life. His parents chose this long before the COVID-19 pandemic gave a lot of families a taste of what it could look like to learn from the kitchen table or the park.
You'd have more time to do what you want. You can go on field trips anytime you want stuff. You can do other things. Like when I was little, I used to do sailing lessons. And I got to actually sail a real boat.
Whoa.
By myself. So yeah, it's fun.
Hope Walsh joined the group last year. She started homeschooling her first grader in part because of how public schools in Florida were handling COVID-19.
The mask mandates dropping made me and my husband both really uncomfortable. My husband was actually a school teacher, and he also quit teaching due to the pandemic, amongst other reasons.
This park day was organized by a homeschooling co-op called Palm Beach County Homeschoolers. Nathaniel's mom, Cheryl Trasco, has been running it since 2009. During the pandemic, Trasco also started a statewide Facebook group that's grown to more than 10,000 members. It's called Homeschooling Florida Style. And like pretty much anything Florida style, homeschooling here is loosely regulated.
So some people go out and buy books and use those to teach their kids. Some people find online programs. Some people have gotten together with some other families or maybe even hired a teacher.
There are no requirements for teachers, no list of required subjects, and there's no set schedule or required number of hours students have to spend learning. Students do have to be evaluated by a certified teacher every year. It's either a standardized test or a portfolio. It's a system that Brian Ray says is becoming attractive to more and more parents. He's the president of the National Home Education Research Institute, a nonprofit based in Oregon. He says the number of homeschooled students across the country has jumped from 2.5 million in 2019 to almost 4 million today.
After tasting some of the benefits of home-based education, many parents, not all of them, have said, we like this. This is good for our children. This is good for our family.
In South Florida, there are almost 8,000 more students being homeschooled now than before the pandemic. In Broward and Palm Beach counties, homeschoolers now make up between 3% and 4% of the total student population. In the Keys, the homeschool population more than doubled.
Today, the demographics of homeschoolers look a lot like the demographics of the country. It's urban, it's suburban, and it's rural. African Americans and Hispanics are now homeschooling in proportional numbers.
John Edelson founded an online homeschool program called Time for Learning, in which nearly 200,000 students are now enrolled. He says the pandemic is only one reason parents have been leaving public schools in droves.
It's often regrettable, and I don't really love to cite it, but school violence, of course, scared a lot of parents, and all those active shooter drills terrified a lot of kids.
Then there's inflation and the cost of living, something that's impacted Melissa Lamonte's decision to enroll her fifth grader Ellie in Edelson's online homeschool program.
We RV life, we do homeschool because I can't find an area that I'm okay with the school system and the cost of housing, so we're doing it our way.
The Lamontes relocated from Virginia to South Florida about a year ago, and they've lived in RV parks in Palm Beach and Broward counties.
There's a whole bunch of different things with the flexibility that it makes it not worth going to school from like 8 to 3 every day.
Her son Caleb is 14 and in 8th grade. He takes his classes from home through Florida Virtual School.
You can like go outside, take a little break real quick, go on a run even, come back with a fresh mind, and the assignment is a lot easier and less stressful.
School districts are funded based on enrollment. So when students leave traditional public schools, the schools lose money. And that means less resources for the students who stay. But that only applies to certain school districts.
I've always been concerned about the funding, and it's even more of a concern now.
Anna Fusco is president of the Broward Teachers Union. She says dwindling enrollment at public schools threatens teachers' salaries, plus staff positions like TAs, counselors, and cafeteria workers. Also at stake, she says, electives like music, foreign languages, and culinary arts.
So if the funding is not there, it does affect every little piece in the schools and in the school district.
Especially in Broward, traditional schools have hemorrhaged students in recent years, and that downward trend is only expected to continue. For Here and Now, I'm Yvonne Zumtobel.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.